You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people.
Hello, hello, hello out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift and or separate them from the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, we would like to welcome you. David and I are old friends that have been hosting this show for six seasons now. And what we like to do is explore pretty much a century's worth of horror and science fiction films. Since films started in the 20s and we're in the 20s now, you've got a whole century of horror and science fiction. We like to pick one of those movies. We like to go into it blind, watch them by ourselves, get together, chat about what we think makes these films special. If you get what I'm saying, you'll understand it's an unscripted podcast, and sometimes we may stammer or stutter. But given that, If you are coming back to us, you already know this. So why am I rambling on? Welcome to my co-host and good friend, David Horton. David, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Glad to be here. Brand new year. Exciting things happening. Crazy things happening. But we're glad to be here and glad to be back. We took a little break over the holidays and glad everybody's joining us again and coming back. And I'm excited about today's topic because it's kind of different for us, but we'll talk about that when we get to it. Normally, we start with our genre week and what we've been doing. I did something really interesting.
What you been watching for the Christmas holidays, David?
This was post-Christmas, so nothing Christmassy about this at all. It actually was a documentary that I just came across. The title of it's called World of Darkness, which I had known that phrase but I thought, oh, it can't be what I'm thinking about. No.
It sounds like 90s. A 70s like television show, like Circle of Horror or something.
Circle of Horror.
Yeah.
No, I knew the title because of the 90s. And I thought, well, it can't be that. I looked at it. Sure enough, it was. So started watching it. Basically, it is a really, really in-depth and well-done documentary. It's about 90 minutes long. So even longer than a normal like hour-long documentary or something like that behind the scenes of the making of essentially the creation of White Wolf, the gaming company that came out of Atlanta in the early 90s, in 89 actually, and totally revolutionized online gaming, role-playing, all of this stuff because they introduced Vampire the Masquerade.
Mm-hmm. I remember those.
Yes. I still have all of the books, all of the clan books, all of the essentially the Dungeon Master books. Basically, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, at that time in the late 70s and all through the 80s, the big resurgence in D&D came about, or not resurgence, but D&D came about. And people, geeks, were getting in their basements and playing Dungeons & Dragons.
It's satanic.
A lot of recent people only see it in reference in, you know, like Stranger Things. The boys are all playing Dungeons & Dragons and all of that. But it was a lot of geekery, a lot of tables, a lot of math, a lot of stuff. These guys had this idea of changing the role-playing world and making much more character-driven and less technical process-driven. And one of them, they were two friends that had done a couple of games together and everything else and came up with the idea of, well, what if we made it about vampires? And let's just say that vampires are exist now, what would vampires be like in the modern world? So they created Vampire the Masquerade, which was essentially that. It's, the documentary is great in all the ideation, how they came up with ideas, how they changed stuff, how it really clicked and hooked in. Not only did it get the D&D geeks, but it also got all of these, at that time, role players or cosplayers. This was when LARPing was just starting. And it was kind of getting a bad rap because people run around with swords and cloaks and trying to be wizards and all of that. Instead, with this, you could essentially be goth and role play an entire evening. So much so that clubs started rising up all over the world. In England, in Denmark, in France, and in, of course, the United States. But these were masquerade clubs where you would come in and everybody in the room is a vampire all night kind of thing. It's a really cool documentary. I really enjoyed it. And if you like, and it revolutionized role play. Role play has since, you know, that's what it's become. And it's all about the failure of a company, because you don't hear about White Wolf a lot anymore.
I remember that name, though.
Yeah, because of what happened to them. And basically, it's the classic story. You know, it's like watching a Behind the Music. You know, the great idea. The band is so good. The group is so great. We make this great game. Ooh, how are we going to better ourselves? Let's do a television series. Oh, it's terrible. Well, let's don't do that then. Let's do, let's do an online game. It'll be bigger and better than every online. No, it doesn't. Boom. Get wiped out. Sort of thing. Lose your creator because he decided to go off on a tangent. They set up like an LA office and he went out there and kind of fell into the LA mainstream away from their Atlanta roots. And so they kind of had to part ways with him. And it's really an interesting story.
Interesting.
But it also deals with, like you hinted at, it also deals with what you said earlier about satanic panic, because that definitely led to a big deal in the mid-90s. When everyone was suddenly, these are all demons and Dungeons and Dragons is satanic and all that.
Well, I didn't play that often, but when I played with you and Wynn and Steve back in the late 70s, early 80s, I would say it'd be the early 80s, we were way ahead of the game as far as that was concerned, because you guys were making up games with like zombies. And that was like long before zombies were what they are now. I mean, we were going based on, you know, the original Dawn of the Dead movie or something.
Yeah.
You know, long before The Walking
Dead. And secret agents and all kinds of stuff that we were playing. Yeah. And our whole thing was just their mentality of it's more of a role-playing game, less of a roll-the-dice game. So don't spend half of your time trying to figure out the odds of hitting somebody. Roll one percentage dice and be done and keep seeing if you can hit him. Figure out the puzzles sort of thing. So, yeah, that's what I did. I watched it. I really enjoyed it. It gave a good flavor to the beginning of my year.
Awesome. It sounds like you indulged a little bit in some nostalgia. Well, I may have indulged in a little bit of nostalgia myself. I finally got around to watching The Evil Dead Rise.
Whoa, okay. Yes.
I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed this film.
Really?
Yeah. Okay, it's directed by a guy named Lee Cronin. Do not know hardly anything about him or what he has done previous. He is Irish. But Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell were on board for this as far as producing. And it's clear the love and adoration for the original film is in every frame of this movie. It looks like a Sam Raimi movie just because of the crazy camera angles and the wild sound effects and music. The sound effects alone will remind you of The Evil Dead. You can remember like, you know, the clock going, you know, making all these crazy noises. Same in this.
Yep.
It stars Alyssa Sutherland and Lily Sullivan. They play sisters. The plot is a little different. They bring it out of the woods. It does have a beginning and an end that kind of bookend it that have to do with being in the woods. But this movie is set in the city, and it tells the tale of two twisted It tells a twisted tale of two estranged sisters, played by Sutherland and Sullivan, whose reunion is cut short by the rise of flesh-possessing demons in a very creepy old apartment building. They are thrust into a primal battle for survival as they face the most nightmarish version of a family you can imagine. I watched this with my nephew Jason. I don't get to watch movies with Jason that often, and he was dying for me to see this. And
oh, he had seen it already?
He had. So he sat down and watched it with me. And yeah, it was like being a kid again and seeing The Evil Dead for the first time. There are even shots. Like, remember I told you how Halloween, the reboot with Jamie Lee Curtis, does real well with paying homage to shots from the original movie and playing around with them? Yeah. Same with this. You know, there are shots in this where, like, you think about what's her face with the pencil in the original. And this one, you know, there's the shot with the cheese grater, almost identical. You're just like, this is awesome. It's scoring 84% on Rotten Tomatoes right now. I would give it much higher, at least a 90. It is well worth seeing. So that is what I did in my genre week.
You said Lee Cronin, and the name, since you first told me about it, has interested me, because I go, I know that name, but I look him up and I go, no, I don't know that director at all. I've never heard of him. However, I did some deeper dive research. Lee Cronin was a pseudonym of a writer, and anytime he did not like it, he used that pseudonym, and that writer was Gene Kuhn.
I think you said this. We've talked about this before. Yeah, I do remember that. How funny.
Lee Cronin was his pseudonym. So, okay, I'm glad I figured that out. But no, I'll have to watch it. Evil Dead Rise.
I hope they get this guy and just do it all over again. Because this is the way a reboot should be done. And I love how they take it and put it in a totally different scenario. And they could do it again. I mean, they could easily do it again elsewhere.
He should do Army of Darkness and go to Spain?
I mean, I did like Army of Darkness, but I kind of like the fact that this movie gets back to the beginning. This is like, this movie reminds me of the first movie. It is not a comedy. It may have comedic elements, but it is very scary. So
good.
Yeah.
It should be.
And speaking of, well, not necessarily scary, but this is, as you mentioned, our first episode of 2024. It is January 8th. Yes. And we have a first that I guess we should embrace before you go on to synopsize it. We've kind of decided that we need to expand our genres a bit, because there are movies that we would like to cover that are not necessarily deeply in horror or deeply in sci-fi. So you have decided to take sci-fi into the world of fantasy as well. Mm-hmm. And I think next year, I don't think I've done it this year, but next year I'm going to take horror into the suspense and thriller as well.
Interesting. That would be interesting. Yeah, we had talked about that, because also we have done sci-fi comedy. We have done horror comedy. Mm-hmm. So we've kind of done some genre blends before. But a lot of times, to your point, a lot of times fantasy movies, when they can't categorize them more towards sci-fi. Thrillers into mysteries end up being classified more toward horror or, you know, fearful films.
Yeah, so, I mean, we've done, we actually did do Silence of the Lambs first season, and that would fall more into a thriller than a horror, probably.
Yeah, but it's still classified by a lot of people as a horror. Just because of.
But I'm thinking of movies like Breakdown, that Kurt Russell movie, or Play Misty for Me. Some of those movies I wouldn't mind tackling as well. And then today, January.
Our first in the fantasy world.
Yes. Immersed. You couldn't get more fantasy than this.
A minor little, you may not have even heard of it, sort of tiny little film that I did something totally different to. We're going to do Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Rings. This was the first in a trilogy of films that ended up becoming six films when they added The Hobbit to it later on. It was a brainchild of Peter Jackson, and it was written by actually Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens. Fran actually happens to be Peter Jackson's partner, so they worked very closely on it. A cast of thousands, but definitely a cast of a dozen that have since gone on to be very well known, done multiple projects, everything else. It was a huge undertaking. It created an entire special effects company called Weta in New Zealand. It was shot in New Zealand primarily, and based on classic literature, probably the classic fantasy literature trilogy of forever, sort of thing, written by J.R.R. Tolkien. Not George R.R. Martin, J.R.R. Tolkien. Brief synopsis, because in case you don't know, by the way, if you have not seen this movie or read the novels or whatever, you might want to go do that, because we will spoil it horribly for you, which we do on everything. But a brief synopsis, the title refers, The Fellowship of the Ring and The Lord of the Rings, refers to the story's main antagonist, the Dark Lord Sauron, who in an earlier age created the One Ring to rule the other rings of power given to men, dwarves, and elves in his campaign to conquer all of Middle-earth. From homely beginnings in the Shire, a hobbit land reminiscent of the English countryside, the story ranges across Middle-earth following the quest to destroy the One Ring, seen mainly through the eyes of the hobbits Frodo, Sam, Merry, and Pippin. Aiding Frodo are the wizard Gandalf, the men Aragorn and Boromir, and the elf Legolas and the dwarf Gimli, who unite in order to rally the free peoples of Middle-earth against Sauron's armies and give Frodo a chance to destroy the One Ring in the fire of Mount Doom. Had you seen this movie before, I'm assuming? You?
I have not seen it since it came out.
Oh, okay.
On DVD for the first time. So I did not see, I think I saw the Two Towers in a theater, but I did not see the other ones in a theater. It's hard for me to remember all this, but I did watch it once on DVD back in the early 2000s.
These movies were released on consecutive Christmases. So I think he released them 3 years in a row on Christmas, but it was around December they were all released.
Mm-hmm.
Because we literally, for the first three films, we took the entire family to Atlanta to visit relatives, and that's where we watched it. It became a family thing. There were like 15 of us. We watched it every year, every premiere of A Lord of the Rings. And, of course, bought the DVDs. Watched them. I've watched them several times. And then I watched the extended cut when he released that once back 20 years ago. But for this one, I decided to watch the extended cut again because I'd only seen it the first time.
Wow.
So it's...
How long is it?
It's almost 4 hours long.
Yeah.
It's 3 hours and 50 minutes. But it's great. It is... If you like the novels, it is so good. But... I will say, and I guess I'll be really scattered in a lot of this with my notes.
How dare
and everything
you?
Because there's so much with these movies. There is so much production. There's so much trivia. There's so much. And I don't want to go into all that because you're going to hear it on every other podcast or YouTube or behind the scenes or whatever. But we'll just hint at some of the highlights and stuff. But Peter Jackson has gone on record several times as saying the theatrical cut is the cut to watch, not the extended cut. The extended cut is for home, for fans, for friends of the book, that sort of thing. It does have a lot more character, but it does slow down the pacing of the movie, in his opinion. But it has so many great Tolkien-esque aspects, and that's why he filmed it that way. I mean, and this is not like, oh, an extended cut where it's a scene that's not colorized or not digitized correct or doesn't have the fast sound effects to it. If you watch the extended cuts of all three of these movies, they are the complete, I mean, they look exactly like there's no cuts at all. It looks like complete works. It's just the theatrical versions were heavily edited down. So that was the first time you saw it. What did you think in the rewatch this time?
I really enjoyed all three movies when they came out. I'm not a Tolkien fan. I mean, I'm not one of those guys that's read the books or anything because I'm not a big fantasy fan. However, I enjoyed them. I was really pleased that they won Academy Awards and were held in high esteem. Watching it a second time, I was a little shocked at how long it was. I had forgotten, but it moves really fast and does not feel like an entire movie to me. It definitely feels like, oh, wait, where's part two? Because this is clearly not the end. You know, it just kind of stops.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my initial feeling upon this viewing.
And it was, I've got a story along with that too. My sister-in-law had never read the books. She's a business person. So fantasy is so out of her realm, not even science fiction. She doesn't like any of that. But so she had never read the books, anything else. I just assumed everybody had read the books, right? We go in, we watch the movie, the lights come up and she goes, "That's it?" And I went, "What?" And she goes, "What? That's the end of the movie?" And I was going, "Well, yeah, I mean, they're coming out with two other ones." And she goes, "What?" she had not done any
so Empire
didn't
know Strikes Back three
movies. It's the biggest key is Empire Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. You have to wait a year to watch the next part, and then a year after that to finish it, sort of thing. This movie, let's talk about this. It's a huge key of this, of course, is the book. That's the key influence on this because this is an extraordinarily faithful adaptation. And there's so much that came from the book. I mean, J.R.R. Tolkien, if you watch documentaries on him and read about him, he was pretty fascinating old British dude sort of thing. But the themes that he explored in this genre of the hero's quest, of course, struggle for good and evil, immortality, death, dangers of power and how power corrupts. He put a lot of his own experiences in World War I into all three of the novels. So that's why the battles are so huge in it and the way the battles are staged and done. He talks a lot about, there's a lot of thematics based on Christianity and prophets and kings and all of that. It's very
archetypical.
It's a very dense fantasy, mm-hmm. but seems very grounded. That's what makes it work as opposed to a lot of modern fantasies that don't, in my opinion. Do you remember when we were growing up and people would talk like, the Sword of Shannara or something like
that? I used to watch The Sword and the Sorcerer. It was a movie that had Richard Mull in it, and it was very horrific. But I have a feeling it would be terrible now.
I remember that one.
Lee Horsley was the hero. Lee Horsley and Richard Mull was the villain. And I just remember there was an altar made of human heads in it. That's what
I remember.
Why
and maybe
I
was jaded because I read Tolkien fairly young, like in middle school. And I remember going to the bookstore and seeing these fantasy covers, and they were all like a Hildebrandt cover with a glowing sword or a glowing gem or people in a cloak on a horse and all of that. And I would go, okay. And I read a couple of them and went, okay, these are terrible. This is so derivative. It's not good, whatever. Because, I mean, he set the benchmark so high for fantasy and how to tell a hero's quest, how to do all of these mythical kind of things and make them feel so grounded. Why? Because in the novels, even, there were maps, there are lineage trees, there's entire languages that he developed. He developed Dwarfish and Elfish for these books. And they're complete languages. I mean, it's not just, I came up with Klingon in a few phrases. They're full, because he was I looked it up. Hold on. I looked up what he was. He was
a linguist?
Not more than a linguist. A philologist, which is the study of philology, I guess.
I don't know what that
is. And philology is not just language. It's how does language interface with the culture. What's the difference between the oral language and the written language? What are the variations of the language and how important it is to the culture itself? So he was so historical that it was very easy, I think, for him to take all of these, I guess, standard or typical recurring themes in history and put them into this fantasy novel.
Huh.
Make sense?
Yeah.
I guess. Sort of
thing. I mean, he's highly regarded. It's funny that you mentioned that people assume that because I like horror or you like science fiction, that we would automatically read these books. I've never read this book, but people assume that I have read this book all the time. I have right. a good friend and he's a relative practically. He's like my brother-in-law. And he gave me the Cimmerillion or something?
Cimmerillion. It's the Bible. Don't read that.
Well, he gave it to me saying, oh, you need to read this. After we had both, I had read The Dark Tower. I turned him onto The Dark Tower, all Stephen King. So he immediately turns me onto the Cimmerillion, assuming that I have read Lord of the Rings, and that book is still sitting on a shelf, and it's never been picked up.
You should read it in order to. So read The Hobbit first, because, I mean, I guess for development, in production, I guess we could say, because we're talking about the original book, though. But she wrote The Hobbit first, which is a novella. It's fairly short. And this was like 10 years later, he finally published Lord of the Rings. And he had wanted Lord of the Rings to just be one massive book and The Silmarillion to be another massive book. That's all he wanted to do, was publish both of those and be done. But his publisher said, no, you have to divide these books into three books. So he divided Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers, and Return of the King into three novels, and then Silmarillion was released later on separate. And Silmarillion literally is the Bible. I've only attempted to read it a couple of times and cannot get through it. I mean, it has entire chapters of, and Aragorn begat so-and-so, and they lived in the land of this for this. You're going, I don't care. No. I can't even pronounce the names, so I don't know.
No.
It is not an easy read because of the languages, the locations, the fact that this is a totally made-up world sort of thing. It is a difficult read. You sometimes have to keep a few little notes on the side so you understand what they're talking about, because they make reference to, you know, the Nazgul, and you don't know what the hell a Nazgul is until, you know, three chapters later.
Right. I talk often about how much I appreciate the ambiguity and being thrown into the middle of things. It's a little more difficult with this because you're being thrown into something where there are multiple languages and multiple cultures. I am currently, as we have discussed several times this season, reading The Dark Tower again. And Stephen King doesn't do that. He doesn't feel the urge to say, oh yeah, you need to know all about the breakers because they're, you know, very relevant to a keystone in the plot. Well, we know that they disrupt the beam. That's all we need to know. We don't need to know their languages or their special powers or what have you. So I don't know where I'm going with this. I think what I'm trying to say is that too much information can distract or bore me, whereas I would rather have less.
Again, and I think that's why I said originally, you know, I watched the extended version, but I could understand exactly why he cut it down for the theatrical. It was nice to know, but unnecessary. The novels are the same way. There's a lot of density to the novels. But the same thing is true for a big key that came out of this, which is Game of Thrones. You know, and it is, if you read those novels, they are extraordinarily dense as well.
I'm sure.
And I think to your point, we've talked about world building and in medias res, where we're just suddenly thrown into something and we have to kind of catch up with the storytelling, and or there is so much world building that has been done so well that we feel really captured in this world. Mm-hmm. And it's really good. If you go too much into little minutia detail, to your point of that, it pulls you out of it. You suddenly realize I'm watching something that I don't need to know how the gun works or whatever, how the sword was crafted. I just need to know the sword cuts.
The sword's magical. That's enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's enough.
Right. I guess instead we've been delving into the actual literary aspects with Tolkien, but maybe we should talk a little bit about Peter Jackson.
Sure, because That's a good link because he is a horror guy.
Yeah, he's pretty much a horror movie director. He, with this movie, he collaborated with, like you said, Fran Walsh, his partner, and Philippa Boyens, that are frequent collaborators of his. Both are women, which I find that very telling. I admire it. What did he direct? Oh, okay. He came from, obviously, early horror stuff. He did a movie called Bad Taste, which I own on DVD. He did a movie called Dead Alive.
You watched that?
Yeah.
Yep.
That's the one.
And Dead Alive.
Dead Alive is his zombie movie. He did a movie called The Frighteners with Michael J. Fox in the 90s. But then he decided, I'm going to do this. And basically put New Zealand on the map as far as filmmaking, because this was enormous. This is probably still the most enormous production that New Zealand is known for, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. By far.
Right.
Definitely.
And not to plug our show, but this is not the only Peter Jackson movie we're doing this season. We're actually going to do another one later on.
I mean, in researching him, he had so many I'd forgotten about. Because I remember Bad Taste, but there was another one, The Frighteners.
Right.
I'd forgotten he worked on that one. Mm-hmm. Brain Dead. I'd forgotten he worked on that one.
I don't remember Brain Dead.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was another zombie comedy kind of
I thought that thing. Was Frank Henenlotter, but maybe I'm wrong.
But in doing research, he is the fourth. He's fourth in line as the greatest or the most, I guess, money-making, highest-grossing film director of all time. He's fourth. That's pretty
important. Well, it's because he crossed the – and this has been done before, but not often. He crossed the line with blockbuster slash Oscar movie, and that doesn't happen that often. Or at least it didn't used to.
When one of our genres wins, you know, or is nominated for Academy Awards, right. It's pretty incredible.
It is. And this is not even really one of our genres, considering that it's fantasy. But it, I mean, we've talked about how Spielberg was ignored for ages because Spielberg directed blockbusters and they didn't feel those were worthy enough for awards. This movie rose to the top of all that flotsam and became, you know, the golden child of, you know, winning awards and being super popular at the same time. So, well, I was going to say, like, it put New Zealand on the map. He is from New Zealand and he wanted to film there. And it's gorgeous. I mean, New Zealand looks like Hobbit Land or what, the Shire, you know, it looks like it was meant to be filmed.
Well, it also looks
there.
Like Mount Doom. It also looks like the Mines of Moria. I mean, all of that is there. It's been on my bucket list for, you know, 30 years.
To go there? To go to New Zealand.
Yeah. I've always wanted to visit New Zealand. And you now can and actually see those, because he built those locations. He built Hobbiton. He built Mordor. He built Gondor, the whole castle of Gondor and everything. So that would be nice to go see. In production, though, going back.
Yeah.
Oh, finishing up the highest grossing, he would be the third highest grossing if it hadn't been for Endgame, which put the Russo brothers above him.
Okay. And that's Marvel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which kind of is another thing that fits into our genre, even though it's, I mean, I guess you would consider it science fiction. It's superhero. It's its own thing. But yeah.
Yeah. It's Spielberg, Cameron, the Russo brothers now, and Peter Jackson.
Okay. So
that's the four. In looking at production of this, he actually got the rights in 97 to begin working on it. He was working on it with Saul Zantz. But I was blown away when it first started, and suddenly I saw New Line as the producer. I went, New Line produced this?
Yeah, I read a
this
story about that.
This is the house that Freddie built?
Well, I mean, there is a story about that. Robert Shea, of course, who you know, basically brought us Freddy Krueger. And Freddy Krueger, of course, saved that company. I read where Peter Jackson was shopping this around as two movies. And everyone was like saying, no, there's just no way. It's too expensive. We can't do it or whatever. And Robert Shea, when he took him there, said, you know what? I'll give you $300 million. you'll have $100 million for each film, and there need to be three. So he was the one that went back to his original idea of saying, no, this can't be two films. It needs to be three.
But originally he was with Miramax. That was with Saul Zantz and everything else. Miramax was telling him, no, it needs to be one. Only one movie. And he went, I can't tell the story in one movie. We'll cut it and, you know, cut it down and tell it. And he goes, I can't. He wanted to do two. Yes. I saw that New Line when they came to, and Shea approached him and said, well, if you'll do three and we can release them a year apart.
Yeah, we'll do it.
And we'll let you do it.
And I was like, damn, man, Freddie made them some money, because that's a lot of money for a movie back then. $300 million.
Well, yeah, but $300 million for three movies.
But that's probably another reason why he filmed it in New Zealand, because he could do it cheaper there. Yeah.
And he could then work with Philippa and work with Fran on crafting it so that they could get a lot of stuff done early.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, all the armor they could make for the first movie so that it could be repurposed and reused in the other two, that sort of thing. So how do we save on special effects? You know, he created Weta so that he could save money, and he's not giving it to ILM or having to go to L.A. for all of his effects. He's literally doing them in New Zealand.
Right.
So, yeah. And Weta has gone on to do amazing stuff. Weta is an incredible company. So they've done some other top tier. They are probably second only to ILM.
I'm sure.
Best special effects houses. So,
as far as other production aspects, I think the music plays a huge, huge part in this movie. And of course, it is not your typical, you know, Jack Horner or the other guy that Spielberg uses all the time. I can't think of his name.
No, it's Howard Shore.
It's Howard Shore. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
We know him, of course, from Silence of the Lamb, but he is also a frequent collaborator of David Cronenberg, who, you know, Ian Holm had worked with Cronenberg on Naked Lunch and Existence, and I think may have been in part responsible for suggesting him to Peter Jackson. Viggo Mortensen as well, as we know, has gone on to be a big staple in David Cronenberg movies as well. So there's a David Cronenberg key here, basically, in regards
to... We're touching around the horror genre.
Right. Well, and I mean, it makes sense. Like you said, Jackson got his roots in horror. So, but I love the music in this movie.
Oh, by the way, the other little tiny movie that Weta did was one called Avatar.
Oh, really?
So that's in my notes.
Yeah. That's your favorite.
Weta did all the effects for Avatar. Person did.
All right, so we talked about Howard Shore. You said the original cut ran 4 hours and 30 minutes. Ooh. I mean, I watched this, and it was only the three-hour version, and it still felt long to me.
Yeah, the extended cut is 355.
Yeah. So. Robert Shea and New Line insisted on a prologue to help explain the story. They wanted it to be a couple minutes long, and it ended up being 7 minutes long.
And it's brilliant, though, too. I love the prologue.
Yeah.
The world is changed. I feel it in the water. I feel it in the earth. I smell it in the air. Much that once was is lost. For none now live who remember it. It began with the forging of the great rings. Three were given to the elves, immortal, wisest, and fairest of all beings. Seven to the dwarf lords, great miners and craftsmen of the mountain halls. And nine rings were gifted to the race of men who, above all else, desire power.
I think it sets the story so well.
It does.
Especially with having Galadriel be the narrator of it. Once you see all three, it makes perfect sense that she would. but the way it sets everything up. And I mean, it is a, to your point, even the theatrical cut, you have to pay attention. You have to kind of look at it and go, oh, okay, so those are the seven rings of men. I get it. Oh, okay, now I get it. Kind of thing, you know, but you can't just be on your phone and watch Lord of the Frickin' Rings.
Nah.
You also should watch it as big as possible because it's a huge, it's an epic film in cinematography, production design in general.
Yeah. Do you know who had the rights first before Peter Jackson got them?
Oh, no, but this scares me, though, because you're smiling. What? Who?
Fory Ackerman.
How did he get Tolkien's right?
Because it says Lord of the Rings had been in process as far back as 1957, an adaptation, when Hugo Award-winning science fiction magazine editor Forrest Ackerman successfully convinced Tolkien to grant him permission to attempt an adaptation.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I could see that, I guess. I mean, it came out in 54. So The Hobbit was written in 37. Fellowship was actually released in 54. And then later on in 55, the other two novels were released.
Yeah.
So he bought it pretty quick then and probably could have gotten it cheap because nobody was doing major fantasy back then.
No one had the money to, and it not look ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah.
Including Ackerman. So, I mean, Ackerman didn't make movies. He was known for collecting memorabilia. So it's almost as if he was just collecting it. I mean, in my opinion, I've never known Fory Ackerman to produce any kind of movie. Have you?
No.
No.
No, no, no. He never produced as far as I know.
But now several other directors have been linked to this movie prior to Jackson. Before Jackson managed to get it, John Borman was linked to it.
Stanley would have been brilliant.
Yeah, Stanley Kubrick was linked to it. And believe it or not, the Beatles tried to make a movie version of it, and they were going to cast themselves.
Oh, I think I'd read that.
Yeah, yeah, because it's a very
John really liked the novel.
And everyone we just mentioned is British. Is Stanley British?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No?
New York.
Okay. So John Borman and the Beatles, though, are, and it the Lord of the Rings is such a British thing. I mean, it's like steeped in the history, or what you might call the fantastical history of the country, that it seems appropriate that it be in the hands of people that are British. Even though Peter Jackson's from New Zealand, most of the cast is British. There are some Americans scattered in there, though.
Well, the lead is American.
Right.
Elijah's American. Yes, it is deeply rooted in European culture, in early European culture. So even the Celts and the Scots and Scotland, Ireland, the way that all works together.
Like clans.
And the way that they – yeah.
It's like instead of clans, you've got elves, hobbits, men –
And they're the three primaries. Mm-hmm. Then you have the other free people, and then, yeah.
Did you want to talk about any scenes before we move on to cast? Because casting could take me a hot minute.
Okay, well, I have 5 scenes.
Oh, wow.
My first is, of course, the prologue. I love the prologue to this, and I think it sets it up so well from a cinematography standpoint, an effects standpoint. Storytelling. So it's kind of like, here's what you get ready. Here we go. This is what you're going to learn about. All this happened before the movie started. So I like that a lot. I have Hobbiton, of course. It sets up, I think, our protagonist so well, and Gandalf, and having Bilbo as kind of a side thing there works too, because he's important to the other trilogy or the other film.
Yeah, I don't know how they interwork together because I'm unfamiliar with both as far as reading.
Well, The Hobbit is a prequel. It is Bilbo's story.
Right.
So how did Bilbo get the ring?
It's The Hobbit. Okay.
Kind of thing. That's The Hobbit.
Okay. Yeah.
So, but I like Hobbiton, and I like it mostly because it is such a faithful adaptation of what you picture when you read the book, because Jackson took over a year to build that set and make that scent work. So that's what makes it work for me. It's very naturalistic. His special effects that he uses for it, the hobbits are little and they appear little, which is great. So I like that whole scene. My third one is one you will probably like too, which is anything with the Nazgul. So the whole Nazgul rider, like on the road, when he stops and they're all hiding right underneath the roadway and the Nazgul leans down and all the spiders and bugs start coming toward him and everything, and it's all evil and the music is great and you never see their faces. Their horses are these great big giant black horses, very Frank Frazetta sort of death look.
Or Sleepy Hollow, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the Nazgul. I like when they attack the tavern and try to stab all the boys, but Strider has taken the hobbits away. The big fight with Arwen when they're suddenly swept away by the waters of Elrond. I mean, the waters near the elvish village of Isengard? Isengard. So, and then my last two, of course, the Mines of Moria are really cool. I think that fight is really... I like Boromir's line of, oh, they've got a cave dwarf. A cave giant, what do they have?
Whatever it is a giant, for sure.
Troll, he goes, right. And they've got a cave troll. And it busts through the door and starts killing them all. I love that.
Yeah, I love the whole interaction of Frodo hiding behind that column and it looking around the sides trying to get him. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, later on, the second part of that battle is the Balrog with Gandalf. I mean, that's such a great epic standoff, you know.
You shall not pass!
If I could easily just limit every scene with Ian McKellen in it is my favorite, because he is fantastic, and I've always known this, and I especially love the scenes with him and Christopher Lee, because I love Christopher Lee, and to see those two actors opposing each other as villains or as enemies is just fantastic. And when you've got these two old men having this like Marvel superhero battle, and they're never even touching each other. They're just like waving their hand and flying across the room, you know, or up into a tower or down into a pit. It's crazy.
Yeah, using their staffs.
Yeah, love that. Yeah, I'm not sure why they gave Christopher Lee a fake nose, but it makes him look a lot different than he normally looks, too.
Looks more gaunt, too, the way they do his beard and everything, too, and his hair is always down, whereas Gandalf's is always kind of hidden by the hat a lot of the time.
I'm like, why are you going to this guy? He is clearly a bad guy. You know it from the minute you see him.
Well, but you don't really. I mean, if you read Silmarillion and everything else, that's his mentor. That's his. Right. He would never think he would turn bad, but. Well,
guess what? It happens instantly in this movie. I mean, he is bad within seconds of Gandalf getting there.
Well, he's been planning this for a long time with Sauron.
Right.
So this was important sort of thing.
But the scenes with Gandalf in the Shire are great too. You know, when he's bumping into things because he's so tall and everything there is so small.
That was an ad lib. That was a mistake on set that they kept. By the way, Ian McKellen really did hit his head and just kept going with the scene. And Peter Jackson said, keep it. I'm going to keep it.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. And Gandalf's death is memorable and important and great. And that fight with the Balrog is good and all that.
And I forgot.
And then my last one.
I forgot he died because he comes back, doesn't he?
We can't give away stuff. We don't need spoilers.
But I mean, it's like Star Wars, you know. He's like Yoda. He doesn't die.
Yeah, that is actually very good key and correct. Yes, he is Gandalf the Grey. He is killed with the Balrog, supposedly. He comes back as Gandalf the White in the Two Towers.
Okay, I knew he came back.
Yeah, he comes back and helps rescue Gondor, essentially, because the Two Towers. The thing I don't like about the trilogy of Lord of the Rings is basically it's the same freaking story told three times.
Okay.
It's we follow the Hobbit And then we have a great big battle, huge fight among, you know, every living thing on Earth. And then it doesn't really resolve, but it kind of does. And then we stop the book and go on to the next one. And we follow the Hobbit. Then we have a great big battle with everybody. So it's, and that's what happens in all three. And there's always something that comes to the rescue in each one. You know, in this one, it's essentially Aragorn is the rescuer because he kind of preserves everything.
He protects Frodo.
It's Frodo's, but it's Frodo's realization that he has to leave the Fellowship. That's what is the saving moment of this battle with the Uruk-hai. And in the Two Towers, it's Gandalf arrives with all of the armies of men to fight off the orcs. And in the Return of the King, Aragorn has gone to the land of the kings and he brings back all the ghosts, and all the ghost warriors come and fight and kill everyone. So it's the same kind of setup all three times. It works, but it's a little derivative, I think.
Cannibalistic.
And my last scene that I like is the Uruk-hai battle. I really like the Uruk-hai battle, although Boromir's death makes no real sense. I mean, he would take two arrows and then the three orcs near him would cut him into little freaking pieces. But instead, they give him three arrows and onto his knees, and they just ignore him and keep running after the hobbits. Like, I don't think that would probably happen, but anyway, it's okay. But that whole scene, and then him and Aragorn having him saying goodbye to Aragorn, his king, and all that was really good and emotional. I like all of that.
I do not know what strength is in my blood, but I swear to you, I will not let the White City fall. Our people fail. Our people. I would have followed you, my brother. My captain. My king.
And the fact that Aragorn gets to kill the frickin' Uruk-hai, the big white-faced orc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know these terms and battles better than I do. Because when you were talking about that battle, I was flashing back to the original battle where the ring is removed from the
Isildur and Sauron.
Right. At the very, I guess that's in the prologue. Yeah.
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 Well, you get a flashback to it later on because the elves, Agent Smith the elf,
yeah,
I'll say it that way for you, tells the story again of the battle and how Isildur refused to give up. He could have destroyed the ring right then,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't because men are corrupt. The hearts of men are corrupt, kind of thing. Again, Tolkien, his thematic, talking about how power will corrupt, yeah. which we see all through all three of these books.
I also like scenes where Frodo is in peril, especially when he's been hurt. He gets hurt a lot.
Yeah,
and
poor Frodo.
His face goes pale, his eyes go pale, and it's like he's only got a few minutes to live. You know, there's always that urgency.
Each time.
Yeah.
Let's all defeat what we're doing so we can run to Frodo's side, only to discover, oh, he's okay.
And I keep thinking, did Jackson cast Elijah Wood because he looks so vulnerable?
I'm sure he did. Because especially if you watch all three of these movies, Frodo has to go through this huge arc of pain the entire time.
Yeah.
I mean, he suffers all three of these movies.
Well, I guess that's a good
Did you
segue.
Have a favorite character?
Favorite character would be Gandalf, for sure.
Gandalf?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I can't. I mean.
See, mine will always be Legolas. Legolas is just cool. He's cooler in the other two, but he's cool in this.
Who?
Legolas.
Who is Legolas?
The elf.
Oh, the one that Agent Smith plays?
No. The one that, what's his name?
Oh, Orlando Bloom.
Orlando
Bloom. Okay, sorry. I had forgotten the names. I was getting the names confused. But yes, I forgot. Oh, look, there we have Christopher Lee. Okay, I guess that's a good segue for casting since we're talking about these characters. I mentioned that the Beatles wanted to start an adaptation of this. They asked Stanley Kubrick to direct it. He declined filming, saying the book was unfilmable. But the cast would have been Paul McCartney as Frodo, George Harrison as Gandalf, Ringo Starr as Samwise, and John Lennon as Gollum. That's pretty good casting.
No, no. I mean, I could have seen them all four as the Hobbits. That might be interesting. Mm. But
and they'd be running around in fast motion singing Help. Yeah.
Yeah, not as the four principals. That would not be. No, 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 no.
All right. Let's start off with the voice of the ring and the voice of narration. Well, actually, it's just the voice of the ring, not narration. It was Alan Howard. Did you know that?
I did not know
Yes.
that. Thank you for saying that.
And as soon as I saw him, I was like, I know that face. When I looked him up, he's obviously not in the movie, just his voice. But he's from The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. Very, very bizarre movie from the late 80s.
Yeah.
And these are in no particular order. I took these from the order that they were listed on IMDb. I guess they're listed in order of, I don't know really how they listed these, but they jump all around. So forgive me for that. I will just mention their name and their character. Sean Astin played Samwise. We know him, of course, from Goonies and Rudy. He is the son of Patty Duke Astin, stepson of John Astin, Gomez himself of the the Addams Family. He gained 30 pounds to play this role. I always thought he was a chunky actor to begin with. I didn't realize he had gained so much weight to play this role.
He's not chunky in Goonies.
He's a little kid in that movie, but in other movies, he's always looked a little heavy to me. Someone else revealed that their first audition was for Samwise in this movie. Do you know who that person is?
I do not.
James Corden. I mean, that's
okay.
Pretty dead on casting. Even though I'm sure Sean was far more experienced, and that's why he got the part. Sala Baker played Sauron the Goblin and Yurkai. We know him from Bullet Train and Deadpool. I don't know why I have that in there. Some of these people I'm just going to glance over. If you look at the list of cast, it is so enormous on this movie. Have to skip some of them. Sean Bean played Boromir, who you mentioned gets killed in this movie. We know him from Game of Thrones. Did he not play Jon Snow?
No,
no,
no, no, no.
Oh, he doesn't? No. I thought he did.
He plays he plays Eddard Stark.
Okay.
And he is, spoiler alert, everybody, cover your ears. He is killed at the end of season one. Well,
he died really quickly.
All the way through the
season.
Yeah. Sean Bean dies in everything.
Okay.
Every movie he's in, he dies. That's a big deal. I think it was in his contract. It's like Charlton Heston having his shirt on.
Oh, my God. Well, I recognized him, even though I've never seen Game of Thrones. And I, for some reason, I guess associated him with Jon Snow because I knew that he died quickly and people got pissed off. Other people that wanted this role or turned it down, Liam Neeson turned it down. And I could see Liam Neeson in that role. He would be pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Another one that is kind of surprising, but when you think about it, could have potentially worked, was Bruce Willis. I mean, you have to take him out of modern cinema and make him look, you know, from that period. I think he could have probably done it.
I think he could. This was 2001, right? So this was after.
It was after his heyday.
Die Hard. I don't know.
But I like the fact that he's American too, because they do cast some Americans in this, including Viggo, who does really well as Aragorn. Billy Boyd played Pippin. Don't know anything else about him. Andy Serkis, of course, is the voice of Gollum. However, we don't really see him very much in this movie.
You only see him in three shots in this movie.
And I think it was before he was cast. I think they went back and added the voice.
I don't know that for a fact from production.
Because, I mean, technically he's big in the next two.
He's integral to the next two.
Right.
Yes.
Right. We know him, of course, from the Planet of the Apes, the modern series, as well as Black Panther. Martin Kasakis played Celeborn. He's in the new XXX movie that's coming out from Ty West, as well as Sin City. And then on to Viggo Mortensen. Mortensen, I have a hard time saying his name, who played Aragorn. This is not the first Viggo Mortensen movie we're doing this season either. We have another one of those coming up.
Yay!
He was in the movie Captain Fantastic. I mentioned he's done Cronenberg movies, including The History of Violence and Crimes of the Future. I think he's a very underrated actor. We don't see him in big movies that often.
No. And I think that's him, too, though.
I do, too.
Based on everything I've read about him, his personality, the way he is on set, the way he interacts with cast and everything, he's a very gentle human, which is interesting that he's always playing these, you know, violent or at least physically active characters. But he's very physically active, too. So, but I get the impression that he's a very gentle soul. And I think you see that in a lot of his quieter moments. Mm-hmm. What he brings to Aragorn is that tortured soul kind of person, which gives him a depth and a character that we really like. You know, his introduction is great. You know, we talk about, you know, coming as writers, or how do you initially reveal your character? What's your character's, you know, reveal into the scene? His is probably one of the best in this. You know, Saruman, Christopher Lee's is, I'm walking down the steps. You know, basically that's my introduction to this movie. Whereas Strider's or Aragorn's is, Mr. Frodo, that guy in the corner's been watching you ever since we came in here. And you suddenly cut and you just see the cloaked figure with the pipe in the corner. And then, you know, it's just very interesting the way they set him up as like, oh, he could be a bad guy, but then nope. He turns out to be the hero.
Right.
And by the end of the trilogy, he is the hero, really. He is the king that is referenced in Return of the King.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. The first thing I think I ever saw him in was G.I. Jane, that Demi Moore movie from the 90s.
Oh, wow. I think the first thing I saw him in was... First thing I saw him in that I remember specifically was Crimson Tide.
Okay.
He's amazing in that because he's the key guy. He's the guy with the key to launch the missiles.
Okay.
So both Denzel Washington and Gene Hackman are fighting over him.
Okay.
So it's a great character.
But anyway, he's a great actor. And like you said, he's a quiet actor. He doesn't do that many big movies. This is probably the biggest property he was ever attached to. Stuart Townsend was originally cast as Aragorn. Viggo replaced him after 4 days of shooting when Peter Jackson realized that an older actor was needed. So Stuart was a little too young. Jackson's first two choices for the role, and these are good choices, were Daniel Day-Lewis and Russell Crowe. I could see Russell Crowe doing this part in a heartbeat. Russell Crowe.
Yeah, but I would probably cast Russell as Boromir.
Right.
I think he'd make a great...
He would make a great Boromir. He was excited about the prospect of being involved with the picture, especially since it's New Zealand, and he couldn't commit to scheduling conflicts in the U.S. Crowe is born and was born in New Zealand. He was raised in Australia, so he is a Kiwi.
Wow.
And wanted to be a part of this.
Yeah, he would have been great.
Someone else turned it down. I doubt this very seriously. I have a feeling he was turned down, and that was Vin Diesel. And another one that turned it down supposedly because of family obligations that I just have a hard time believing is Nicolas Cage.
Oh my God, please, no.
Right. I'm like saying Nicolas Cage and Vin Diesel to me are pretty much the equivalent, you know, of B movie actors.
Oh, yeah.
They don't need to be in this. Now, another person that's not a B-movie actor, but that was very young and new in this movie, was Orlando Bloom, who played Legolas, as you mentioned. He went on, of course, to do Pirates of the Caribbean a few years later and Black Hawk Down. Mm-hmm. He landed this role 2 days before he finished drama school. He did most of his stunts, and he also broke a rib in the process.
Well, you know, and you know, side note with that one, Viggo was the same way. Viggo did a lot of his own stunts. Yeah. He ended up breaking a toe that they kept the scene actually in the film. He also insisted on an actual sword.
He did not want that.
An aluminum. Yeah. So he when he's wielding his sword, it's a heavy implement.
Wow. Yeah. Kate Blanchett played Is that how you say it?
Galadriel.
We, of course, know her from the movie Carol, the movie Elizabeth. She does lots of movies that are female names, by the way. And she did the movie The Gift with Sam Raimi. Pregnancy changed Peter Jackson's vision of Lord of the Rings because there was someone else he was originally going to cast. Two people he had in mind before Cate Blanchett, and both of them got pregnant. Do you know who they were?
No.
Well, one is Lucy Lawless. And is she from New Zealand?
Yes.
I thought she was because she did those Xena things and then she ended up with Sam Raimi.
She's married to who?
Isn't she married to Ted Raimi?
Bruce Campbell? I mean, she's married to now I'll have to
Tapper
and change it. Rob
Tapper. One of the Sam Raimi crew. I knew it was, I couldn't remember if it was his brother or what, but yes. Okay.
Producer. Married to
right. Well, Lucy was pregnant, so she couldn't do it. And also, Uma Thurman was considered, but she was pregnant at the time and could not do it. Oh, you know what? I said something wrong. Sorry. Lucy Lawless was considered for Galadriel and Uma Thurman for Arwen, but both of them got pregnant, which led to Cate Blanchett and Liv Tyler being cast respectively. Sorry.
Yep.
I had them pinned for the same one, and it was two different.
Both really good.
Right. Mark Ferguson played Gil-galad. Ian Holm played Bilbo Baggins. Ian Holm is always, he's always been one of my favorite actors. I love him. Oh, we know him from Alien, where he played the evil Ash that sought to impregnate poor little John Hurt with an alien egg. He was always Peter Jackson's first choice to play this role.
I can see that.
Yeah, I could too. He looks like a hobbit in a way. He's got a mischievous face. I mean, Peter Jackson looks like a hobbit to me.
He was called that in production.
They
called him the Big Hobbit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Ian McKellen teased Ian Holm. They're both sirs, by the way. Sir Ian McKellen teased Sir Ian Holm that his old age makeup made him resemble Dame Judi Dench's mother, which I find very funny. A little bit of British humor there. And to one of my favorites, and this is the one I probably have the most info on, Christopher Lee played Saruman. We know Christopher Lee, of course, from the Hammer films. And most recently, a couple months back, when we did Sleepy Hollow, Christopher Lee was a huge fan of the novel. He read the book once a year until his death in 2015.
Once a year?
And had done so since the year it was published. I find that hard to believe, but whatever. He was also the only member of the cast and crew to have ever met J.R.R. Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first person to be cast in the trilogy because of his extensive knowledge of the books. He frequently visited the makeup department and often gave tips about the facial features and designs of the monsters. While Christopher Lee was always Jackson's first choice for the role of Saruman, Jackson did consider some others, and these are great people he considered. He considered Tim Curry, he considered Jeremy Irons, and he considered Malcolm McDowell. But
okay.
I love Christopher Lee, and I'm glad he's in this part. Okay. While filming this, he nearly severed two of the fingers on his left hand. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Yeah, he suffered jet lag in his hotel room, woke up late one night, and stumbled in the dark while trying to find the bathroom. And I guess fell and probably broke both his fingers backwards, maybe on a door jamb. Jackson's shot around Saruman's injury, Christopher Lee's injuries by having the shot avoid his left hand in frames in many scenes, even holding off shooting scenes to allow this injury to heal. Several brief moments for his left hand were not shown, but when Saruman shows the Planeteer to Gandalf, Lee's left hand is covered by his sleeve, and when his hand was healing. But despite his injury, Lee credited Gandalf actor Ian McKellen for helping him through this pain, through the strong friendship they formed while working on the set. I love this. They became really good friends, even though they were like enemies on screen. they were really good friends mm-hmm. off screen, and that their friendship that they formed helped him heal. They had a shared sense of humor. And in Christopher Lee's autobiography, he wrote of Ian McKellen, "Nobody could have been more helpful when I had this accident than Ian McKellen. Immortal enemies while the cameras rolled, we became great friends and shared a lot of laughs other times." So
I knew you would like that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome, awesome, awesome.
Well, and there's a lot, like I said, there's so many places you can find all the trivia and the stuff and the production and mm-hmm. all this, you know, behind the scenes. But certain elements of it that bubble up all the time are the camaraderie of this cast. This cast got along extraordinarily well, especially considering certain things they had to do.
Special got tattoos
and everything else. Yes, they all got matching tattoos. I thought it was interesting. They got the Elvish word for nine was what they all got tattooed. And then the next day, Peter Jackson came in and got the Elvish word for 10. He got a tattoo as well. But
like eight of them, I read, got tattoos.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but eight of them did. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the core fellowship mm-hmm. essentially did that. They banded together really well, considering all the hardships they had to do. Like certain locations, the only way they could get there was by helicopter. So all the crew has to helicopter up. Then all the cast has to get in makeup, helicopter up to shoot some of these, especially going across the mountains and in the snow and all that sort of scenes. One of the stories I read was that Sean Bean was terrified of flying.
Yeah, he wouldn't fly.
And so when they were filming some of the mountain scenes, he actually hiked up the mountains in costume, like a 2-hour hike to get there rather than take the helicopter up in 10
minutes. Well, and he's in much better shape than the rest of them.
Go for it, I guess. Yeah, if you want to, that's fine. But, you know, when you think about it, too, just other production hurdles they had. I mean, he used a lot of forced perspective in this. So, like, when you're seeing Ian Holm and Ian McKellen together, they're standing this far apart.
Right. To make one look taller.
They're feet and feet and feet apart from each other so that one looks bigger in the camera than the other
right.
does. And it's just crazy. A lot of the hurdles that they had to do it. This movie also still holds up really well. This is from 2001.
Right.
And it looks amazingly good.
It does look good. And it's 22 or 23 years old now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it looks great. It really does. Cinematography, lighting, makeup, everything.
Yeah.
Pippin still sucks. I hate the character of Pippin all the way through all three freaking movies.
Do you?
And he sucks. Oh, yeah.
To me, they're just like frivolous side characters, him and the other
one. No, he's the one that always gets them in trouble.
Okay.
Always.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
In the tavern, he's the one that says, "Oh, Bilbo Baggins, he's my friend. He's right over there." It's like, no.
Right.
Don't tell me. And in the Mines of Moria, he's the one that tries to pick up the gold and it knocks the whole armor
down the
off
well.
And awakens.
Yeah.
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 I mean, it just always sucks. I hate Pippin.
Well, we left off with Christopher Lee and that once.
Oh,
and no, that's no big deal. We needed a little bit of a break because casting's pretty long in this one. That leads me to my other favorite, Ian McKellen, who to me, this movie, I mean, Ian McKellen to me is just a landmark in this movie. I cannot imagine this movie without him. However, he was not cast originally. There were many other people chosen for this part before he got it. And of course, we know him from X-Men and At Pupil. I say these because I always pick the titles that are sci-fi horror relevant. At Pupil is obviously not a big movie, but Sir Sean Connery was offered $10 million per film for the role of Gandalf and turned it down, reportedly for not understanding the story.
Yeah, not understanding his part, because, I mean, Gandalf's basically mystery man leader, dies, comes back, and then really just kind of helps him out a little bit, but that's basically it.
Well, not appearing in this trilogy cost Sean Connery $450 million. So I'm assuming that Gandalf, or should I say Ian McKellen, maybe also had a piece of the film as well.
Sure.
Sir Patrick Stewart, a very good friend of Ian McKellen.
Of Ian McKellen. Yeah.
Was also offered the role of Gandalf, but turned it down because he didn't like the script. Probably because it was so damn long.
Yeah, could be.
Christopher Plummer was offered the role of Gandalf.
Ooh, that would have been nice.
But he turned it down because of the long commitment. And it was a commitment. It was like a 10-year commitment, wasn't it? It was a long commitment.
No, it was 4 years.
4 years. Okay. Sorry. I had it too long.
But 4 years solid. I mean, these people are used to, I'm coming in for 4 weeks to do this freaking movie.
Right.
And they were telling them 4 years.
That's a long time.
Probably the majority of that time in New Zealand.
Right.
So you have to relocate.
Yeah. Could be fun, though.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be a lot of fun.
I'll do Gandalf. Let me go.
No, you won't, because Ian McKellen is Gandalf. Tom Baker, who played Doctor Who, was also a candidate for the role of Gandalf after his brief but praised cameo as the dying Elven King in Dungeons & Dragons 2000. He turned it down, not willing to spend 16 months in New Zealand, as we mentioned.
Yeah.
And then lastly, Patrick McGoohan and Sir Nigel Hawthorne both turned down the role of Gandalf due to ill health because they were both much older. So.
Yeah, and that's a correction. I think you're right. It was a 16-month commitment on location, a 4-year full commitment because of dubbing, reshoots.
And soundstage or what have you. Yeah, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So there you go. Like 6 or 7 other people were offered Gandalf before it went to Ian McKellen, who to me, I can't imagine this movie without him in it. I really can't.
No, he's perfect.
Yeah.
And he's the perfect icon of a wizard.
Yeah, because he's not perfect. He's got flaws.
From design to execution, yeah. Everything. Yes, he's a wizard.
Right. Yeah. Lots of other people that I don't have any information on. Peter McKenzie played Ellen Dill. Sarah McLeod played Rosie Cotton. Dominic Monaghan, who we know from Lost, played Mary, Pippin's friend, in their little quadruple gathering of Hobbits. Craig Parker played Haldir. Cameron Rhodes played Farmer Maggot. John Rhys Davies played Gimli.
Gimli.
The only reason I have him in here is because he was in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
He played Sala.
Sala.
Yeah. I was like, damn.
He was also the winged Viking kind of guy in Flash Gordon. That's John Rhys Davies, too. And then he went on to do television. He was in one of those time travel stories or some Sliders or something.
Mm.
He did that forever and forever. But yeah, when you see, especially you see it a lot more in the other two movies because they focus a lot more on what I call the trio, which is Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli.
Okay.
And John Rhys Davies is actually taller than Viggo Mortensen.
Really?
Yet he comes up to below his waist.
Because he's a troll or an ogre or something.
He's a dwarf. He's a dwarf.
Dwarf.
He's a dwarf.
Yeah.
Don't insult him, troll.
Sorry. This but is yeah, for that role.
Nobody tosses a dwarf. No.
Warwick Davis auditioned for that part. He might have been really short. Timothy Spall and Robert Trebor also auditioned for that role. Arwen was played by Liv Tyler. Liv Tyler was pretty big at the time because she had been in Armageddon. I know her from the movie The Strangers, which is a horror movie. I also know her because she's Steven Tyler's daughter, and I'm a huge Aerosmith fan. Liv Tyler accidentally stabbed herself in the right thigh while filming this. A lot of people got hurt on this movie.
Yeah. Shot for 16 months. So think about it. Same thing we said about The Exorcist. You know, the longer you shoot, the more likely people
an accident's going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was during the filming, the If You Want Him, Come and Claim Him sequence. The footage was featured in bloopers, apparently, and outtakes of the movie. I did not look them up, but I'm sure they're funny.
And they're good. They're funny. Yeah. She's basically, she's sheathing it and just stabs herself because she's on a horse and the horse is moving and bucking in the water and everything else. Yeah.
Other people associated Helena Bonham Carter expressed an interest, but apparently that never came through. And then one that I just find hysterical, Kylie Minogue stated in a 2009 interview that she auditioned for the role. And I love Kylie Minogue. I think she is a fantastic singer, musician, artist, what have you. But I never have thought of her as an actress at all. She's like Madonna, basically. I don't think of Madonna as an actress either.
No. Nope.
Another of your favorites.
Now, Lady Gaga, on the other hand, Lady Gaga, good actress.
Yeah. Yeah, she is. She is. Hugo Weaving.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. He's not got a really big part in this film. He's in a few scenes. We know him, you know, as Agent Smith in The Matrix. I know him, obviously, from Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. That's the first thing I ever saw him in. And then, of course, he's done Marvel movies and tons of stuff. He may be the biggest star in this movie, now that I think about it, as far as track record.
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
Well, Ian McKellen is big, too.
Well, yeah, he's in Marvel movies, too. You're right. You're right.
But Hugo Weaving is Red Skull and everything. So he's been a lot.
Right.
And his character in this, you actually see in the other two movies, a lot stronger. He becomes a
right.
Lot
he's in the stronger. Prologue of this movie, and then he's in the scene where they go to Rivendell, and that's about it for this movie.
Yeah. In the hierarchy of the storytelling, this is the end of the elves. This is the third age of Middle-earth, and this is the elves are leaving. They have been around for 3,000 years. So they're, and by being around means not generations, no, being them. They're alive. Galadriel is 3,000 years old.
Right.
Sort of thing. So they're leaving and they're turning the world of Middle-earth over to men, essentially. Men, hobbits, dwarves, whatever. So it's the loss of enlightenment. That's a kind of an under theme that Tolkien was playing with a lot too, which is the smart people are leaving us and they're going to leave us and we have to fend for ourselves kind of thing. It was that end of the 20s kind of feel of, the roaring 20s kind of feel going in after World War II. And now that's going away and we're building up for war again. Kind of, that's what he was saying between like World War I, World War II and those kind of.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned it earlier and I didn't comment, but you said this came out in the 50s. And for some reason, I always think Tolkien wrote this in like the 19th century, like late 1800s, yeah. But it really came out in mid 20th century. So that I never put those two together. Back to Hugo Weaving, he played Elrond. Someone else expressed an interest in the role. Do you want to? And it's a good one.
Leonard Nimoy.
No. Kinda. David Bowie expressed an interest in the role. We had already seen him play the Goblin King in Labyrinth by that point, because that was in the 80s. But Jackson stated, to have a famous, beloved character and a famous star colliding just made him uncomfortable. And I could see that. Plus, it is really close to what he would have looked like in Labyrinth, you know? When you think about it, maybe not the Tina Turner wig, but the ears for sure. So anyway, I think Hugo Weaving's fabulous, because I just think Hugo Weaving can do pretty much anything. He's awesome. And then lastly, that brings us to Frodo, who was, as I said, played by Elijah Wood. We know him from Radio Flyer when he was very, very small. And
very cute.
All the way through the current show, Yellow Jackets, now on Showtime. He is in that as well. He's also a big horror movie lover. I've noticed he's done several horror movies and I think produced several horror movies as well. He was the first actor cast in this film. Last one I'm talking about, but the first one cast on July 7th, 1999. He became Frodo.
Wow.
One other person auditioned for this role. Would you like to share a guess?
Judd Nelson. No, I don't.
Judge too old, but you're if you think about the time placement, Jake Gyllenhaal auditioned for this. Little Jake Gyllenhaal.
Little Jakey Gyllenhaal, yeah.
He auditioned for Frodo.
What makes Elijah work so well as Frodo are definitely his eyes and
great
ability he has to, like you said, play the pain, but more than that, play the suffering. Frodo has to deal with a lot of stuff going on. And in the book, it goes into what he's seeing and what he's feeling and all this kind of stuff. We can't do that because he's, you know, what Jackson did very intelligently is this isn't like Dune where we have like voiceover all the time. The only time we really hear voiceover is with like the elves when they're literally communicating to someone telepathically. It's not, oh, I wish I could have that. Da, 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 da. It's not that. So Elijah Wood being able to play Frodo with all these conflicting things of, I'm going to leave my friends. If I don't, they'll die. And I can't have that happen without saying that.
Right. Plus all the conflict that everyone experiences when they have the ring. The whole, I'm going to be a bad guy.
Fighting temptation.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Although I will say, I have it in my notes. I will say that Frodo Baggins has the dirtiest palms of anybody. Every time he opens his hand, it cuts to that close-up of the ring. There's dirt in all every crevice. And
I also read that they were talking about how many close-ups of hands they have in this, and that you could always tell he bites his fingernails because his fingers look chewed. His fingernails look chewed.
His fingernails
are
chewed. Yeah. And again, just incredible effects work because the ring that actually emblazons when they put it near the fire or when it gets near evil and suddenly you see the elvish on it, the wing, the span of that ring, that special effects ring, is like 5 feet. It's huge. It's ginormously big. And it looks like it's sitting in someone's palm the way it's edited and done.
Wow.
It's very well done.
Yeah. And then lastly, in concluding all this casting stuff, I mentioned Stanley Kubrick in relation to the Beatles as far as this film, but it went a little bit further than that. And this is a little bit of a Spielberg connection I think you'll appreciate. Stanley Kubrick considered directing an adaptation of this movie, but ironically, his death indirectly allowed Peter Jackson to get the cast he wanted. Because Ian McKellen and Cate Blanchett were going to appear in Minority Report. But Kubrick's death caused Spielberg to delay that movie and make AI first, which freed up Ian McKellen and Cate Blanchett to do this. And we already talked about it being such a huge commitment. So, so Stanley Kubrick, in a way, affected this movie as well as
Contributed.
Spielberg. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's interesting. I have a question.
Sure.
So you've never read the books.
No.
Was this movie easy to follow? Because I struggle because I know so much about it that I kept thinking in parts of it, wow, if you didn't know what Numenor is, would this make sense?
What is Numenor?
Numenor was the original land that Sauron came from.
No, I mean, I don't know anything about it. Like I said, sometimes the less you know, the better.
Right. It didn't affect you appreciating the story.
No, I think, like you said, the prologue is masterful. That gives you all the backstory you need in 7 minutes. And then I like the ambiguity. When they say Rivendell, it sounds like a place elves would live, so I don't have a problem associating Rivendell with the elves. The Shire sounds like a place hobbits would live. So, I didn't have much problems following it at all. Mm-mm.
Did you struggle with, like, relationships? So, the way it flows, we follow the hobbits, yada, yada, until they get to Rivendell. Rivendell is then essentially the beginning of the fellowship. You've even got a picture right there. That's when all the men meet, all the dwarves meet, all the elves meet, all the hobbits meet, the wizards there, and we have to decide what to do with this thing. And Frodo is the one that steps up and says, I'll take it to be destroyed. And we form the fellowship.
Right.
Did you struggle with like Boromir and Aragorn and their history, or Aragorn and Arwen, or any of that?
Well, I know that Aragorn and Arwen are like a romantic interest. I know that Boromir is related, either Boromir or Aragorn are related to the king that had the ring and abused it. One of them's like in direct line in lineage to him, right?
Aragorn is direct lineage to to Isildur, the guy that cut the ring off Sauron.
And took it.
And then took it and lost it.
Right.
So, yes.
So I knew that there was lineage in men, quote men, through Aragorn. Right. I couldn't remember if it was him or Boromir, because I kind of associate, you know what, if anything, out of all of this, those would be the two I confused the most, except I know Aragorn goes on to be the hero because Boromir dies. But those two look similar and may be the most confusing to me.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think that's a unique storytelling point that's kind of confusing in the book is, I mean, if you haven't read the book, just because you don't have the backstory of these guys. Mm-hmm. So you don't have, I mean, they try to keep Aragorn's a mystery because they want later on when in Return of the King, you find out the full lineage and the history and why he turned away, and why he became a rogue. I mean, what do they call him? They call him not a raider. They call him his name is Strider, but he is, anyway, he's a guy who's like a nomad. He's given up his country. He's gone a ranger. Call him a ranger. But Boromir, you don't get any backstory on him either, other than the fact that he really wants that ring. He thinks the ring can save men and help men defeat evil, meaning whatever the evil they decide that is, kind of thing. And he sacrifices himself for Frodo finally at the end.
It's a huge metaphor for men in power these days now. And politics.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah. We need to have nuclear power so we can rule the world or what have you. Yeah.
And he refused to accept the lineage of Aragorn, who really would be king. They would be conflicting people for the kingship of Gondor. So, which you find out in later movies. But I was just curious, if you hadn't read the novels, would this feel either dumbed down? Or, which some critics have said, or would you be, it would be difficult to follow? And obviously it wasn't, so that's a good thing.
And you know, I would be the one to bitch about it because I'd be like, fuck all these names. No, I don't have a problem. And you know what? Jackson, kudos to Jackson for doing that because, I mean, this movie wouldn't be as well liked or well respected had people not been able to understand it. So the way correct. He did it, worked for not just me, but mainstream everybody. As far as awards, this movie won slews and slews. That's my exact quote there. It was nominated.
Slews and slews.
It was nominated for 5 Oscars, including picture, supporting actor, Ian McKellen, director, screenplay, and art direction. But it did not win any Oscars. It went on to win Oscars in future installments.
Yep.
This movie won 2 BAFTAs because why? The BAFTAs are in England, and this is an English movie, as I said. It won film and director, and it was nominated for feature film, screenplay, and leading role. Again, Ian McKellen. I keep mentioning this because Ian McKellen is the one that keeps getting noticed in this. The Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror gave it 3 wins. They gave it fantasy film, supporting actor, McKellen. I love how sometimes he's supporting and sometimes he's leading, but he wins anyway. Yeah.
Depending on what we need.
Yeah. And director. And lastly, this movie is on the 1001 movies you must see before you die. Something that doesn't happen with us that much anymore. So, oh, look, he's in the Shire.
There I am in the Shire. Yeah.
You could have my Mordor back if you don't like the Shire.
No, I want to be Shire.
Okay.
I'm going to be the Hobbit.
So anyway, those are the awards. And I guess we're obviously running long because this is a long movie. But did you have any other little bits before you wanted to move on to keys?
No, we can move on to keys.
Well, I have – the only thing I had other than keys was what you've already talked about, them all getting the tattoo 9. So that's really all I had.
Let me double check just to make sure. But no, I don't think I have anything. Pippin sucks.
Apparently, you can see Orlando Bloom's tattoo in Pirates of the Caribbean. I didn't know that. That's funny. Ian McKellen has one on really his shoulder. So Ian McKellen got one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the fellowship got them. So Boromir, the Hobbits, the Elf.
Sean Bean, Viggo Mortensen. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, there's like a million keys to this, so I don't know how we're even going to narrow it. I mean, I have a few. I didn't – when I'm overwhelmed with keys, I tend to shut down. I'm like, yeah, this is a fantasy epic. There's a lot of shit. We can
say that – yeah. And this literature influenced so much, and we're not going to be able to list all of it, but, you know, you guys give us some of yours key things. And this film influenced so much. So we can isolate the two, I guess, but they're kind of together. I mean, intrinsically. You know, one of my biggest ones are all of the ones that have come since then. By ones, I mean the huge fantasy, either trilogies or multi-books or whatever, you know, Harry Potter, Game of Thrones. Those are definitely influenced by the literature of Tolkien. And then by the films or the series are influenced by this movie. Are these series of movies? You know, one of the things I have is Harry Potter, Endgame, or the Russo brothers in general, Marvel to an extent, are influenced by these movies because these movies were shot consecutively, like all at the same time, knowing that they would be distributed separate, as separate films, kind of thing. Same way the Russo brothers shot Infinity and Endgame at the same time, knowing that they were going to cut it into two movies.
You're saying it key-wise to what? Marvel and Star Wars and those type films because of the fact that they're planned out?
Well, specifically to Endgame, Infinity Wars, and there was one other one I just mentioned. I can't remember it right now. But yeah, that they were shot consecutively knowing they'd be distributed.
I mean, I don't know.
So they shot They shot Infinity Wars and Endgame at the same time. In like 4 months, they shot both movies. And then they went into special effects and distributed them at two different times. The same way Peter Jackson said, hey, I can save money and be more productive if I shoot all three of these movies essentially at the same time.
Yeah. And then it's we'll not cut the them first up. Time it's happened. But yeah, I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean.
But very influential now in cost cutting and how to keep consecutive order and all of that. So
I'm trying to find this fantasy movie that we should put on our list because I remember liking it, and it's from the 80s. And if I'm not mistaken, it has Rutger Hauer and Jennifer Jason Leigh. Wasn't it called?
You're not talking about Lady Hawk,
right? No, but Lady Hawk's another good one. Yeah. And you could actually, there's keys to that in this as well. No, the one I'm talking about is called Flesh and Blood. But it wasn't coming up because it says flesh plus blood for some reason on IMDb. But do you remember watching that? I remember watching that with you and liking it.
Yeah, I think that was good.
Yeah.
From what I remember, I would have to review to see.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, it's the 80s. You never know. But Lady Hawk is another good one.
A key that hits me every time I watch this is Wizards. Do you remember the Ralph Bakshi movie Wizards?
I don't know that I've ever watched it, but I know you had the poster on your wall.
Yeah, and it started out with this kind of prologue, with a female voice telling the history before the Armageddon kind of thing. And it was very inspiring, very, very similar influence to this. I'm not sure if Peter Jackson saw that and said, let's do that or not.
No, there's actually more connection to the Bakshi version of Lord of the Rings that's animated. And I thought you were going to mention that because even Bakshi was a little bit jealous and said, wow, I wish I could have done that. And Peter Jackson literally set up shots to mimic some of the animation from that movie. So they fed off of each other.
The big one that they always show in trailers and everything else, which is that shot at the top of the mountain, is they each come over and they each kind of have a cameo kind of second like of looking call. Off in the distance kind of thing. That's directly from the Bakshi version. You know, it's the same shot.
Yeah.
So that's really good. I had, of course, I said Harry Potter. I think Harry Potter, this is a huge influence.
Some of
on
those
Harry
movies
Potter.
Were filmed together, weren't they? Like that goblet one?
Correct.
Yeah.
The last three were shot
together. Mm-hmm. So, but just in the novels and in the storytelling, this hero's quest of you don't know your full power and all of that, led by a wizard who dies halfway through the storytelling, mm-hmm. all of this kind of thing.
We didn't mention the book, but of course the book would be the obvious key. I mean, that's the huge one. That's what it's based on. And you mentioned the Silmarillion. I guess I should put that in there as well.
No, Silmarillion is essentially the Middle Earth Bible, essentially. It tells the entire mythos of Middle Earth in this very chapter oriented quantitative short story sort of approach.
Mm-hmm.
Little fables and stories.
I mentioned the Cronenberg tie. You mentioned the Game of Thrones tie. There's a huge tie to Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah.
With this.
Not only the novels, but the series, too. And not only the series, but the new series. So you've got also House of the Dragon, which is very influenced by Tolkien.
And apparently there's another one, Jon Snow, I saw advertised the other day.
Correct. That's coming out. That's a sequel.
Prequel.
That's coming out.
Interesting.
House of the Dragon is a prequel to Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Snow, I think they're just going to call it Snow, is the sequel coming, what happened after that story. You had said Empire Strikes Back. I think that's a huge key in this.
Because it doesn't end. It just stops.
It doesn't end. It is a cliffhanger and a half, just leaving you.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of those movies when that happens. I'm going to say Sword and the Sorcerer just because I'm dying to look that movie up now because I remember it well. Yeah. I saw that at the theater several times. The special effects kind of blew me away. Of course, it was the 80s, mm-hmm. but it had Lee Horsley in it, a television actor, and Richard Mull, who was a television actor. And big fantasy, dark fantasy epic.
Well, and I think another series or whatever that both literature and film, now television, that is tied to this is Wheel of Time. The Wheel of Time series by Sanderson, I think is his name, is hugely influenced by this. I mean, instead of orcs, you got Trollocs. Yeah. Instead of wizards, you've got the Forsaken. So it's hugely influenced, and it's got its own television series now, getting ready to have season two.
Great. I thought you hated it.
Hate, love the novels. Hate the series. Speaking of series, though, there is a prequel to this that came out. I think it's HBO. Might have been Amazon. Anyway, Rings of Power. I think you would like Rings of Power a lot. I would recommend you watch it. But it's the prequel to all this. So this is, how did Sauron rise to power? How were the rings made?
Is Jackson producing that, or is it totally different?
I do think he is producing that, actually. It is heavily influenced. I mean, you can see the production design influence in it. But you find out in that about wizards and where they actually came from.
Is that Amazon?
Numenor, and I'm pretty sure it's Amazon.
Maybe I'll watch that.
You should. I think you would really like it.
Who am I fooling? There's too many Evil Dead movies out there to watch. Another epic that I have to mention, and I know I've talked about this a lot lately because I've been rereading them, is Stephen King's Dark Tower series. Because if you go back and look at Stephen King's intentions of writing that very first Dark Tower novel, his inspiration was Tolkien. He said, I wanted to write my own Lord of the Rings. I was a college student. I had read it and I was fascinated with it. And I wanted to do the Sergio Leone, you know, type modern version of science fiction version of Lord of the Rings. So the Dark Tower is definitely a key to this, those books and the hopefully new show coming from Mike Flanagan, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So
you had mentioned Star Wars. We have to include Star Wars in this.
Anything with a hero's journey.
Yeah, but not just, I mean, I've got it listed out in my notes. It's not just the hero's journey. It's, and all of these, Wheel of Time, Game of Thrones, Star Wars, Harry Potter, all of them are the middle story. They start out with a middle story and they tell a prequel or tell a prologue where there was an evil lord kind of thing that rose up. He was defeated, but he said he would come back. We're hoping he doesn't come back. Now the dark times are here. He's back. There's this whole hero's journey going through it where they have a mentor that has to die or be sacrificed halfway through the story. I mean, it's all these same tropes all the way through all of these stories, yet we love all of them. It's very interesting because I think there's some kind of tap into mythology that we like, that we like feeling like we're in the middle of the story. There's an ancient evil, and then there's a, oh, I don't know what's going to come in the future.
I don't know about the mythological aspect, but I definitely think the hero's journey would be a key to this. The whole, what's that guy that did that?
Campbell.
Joseph Campbell, yeah, because that arc is definitely in this story, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, Babylon 5, I've got in my keys. It's the same way. We start out in the middle. There is an ancient evil that was defeated, and now it's rising again. And we've got to take all these desperate cults, clans, houses, whatever, put them all together to make one army to fight the evil that's rising, kind of thing. So it's a very, I don't want to say standard, because I think each of them do their own little world building around it. But it's very tropish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a trope, or it's an archetype, if you want a better word, because trope sounds like the knockoff of archetype. But archetype is something that's in our genetics or in our storytelling history. So, yeah, for sure. I have a few I lifted also from IMDb. The designs for the Mines of Moria were inspired by two artists. One was a Venetian artist named Giovanni Battista Piranesi, but they were also inspired by Dutch artist M.C. Escher, who we are more familiar with.
Yeah.
So you can tell he lifted some of that design from those two artists.
And when you eventually watch Harry Potter, you'll see that in the staircase design at Hogwarts, too.
Okay.
Same production.
Well, it's in the haunted house at Disney World, too, so there you go.
There you go.
Any others?
One of my last ones is Dune, because I think these novels influenced Herbert in writing Dune, and I think these movies definitely influenced Denis Villeneuve in his version of, not so much David Lynch's, but definitely Denis, because it's so epic and huge in the way it's shot and filmed. I mean, I was looking at certain things in this going, wait, that shot was in 2001 he shot this? Because there's a great shot with in the battle of the Uruk-hai at the end where Aragorn is fighting and he tells Legolas to go, or they hear the horn. And the camera goes up, pans over. There's hundreds of people running, and it goes through the woods and over and scoops around and finally comes back down. I was going, that was a huge freaking that wasn't a drone. They didn't have drones.
I was going to say, it looks like a drone.
Huge freaking crane shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. All those shot, those huge epic ones of even them in the boats, you know, going down the rivers. Mm-hmm. That was helicopters. They didn't have drones. I was going, this is amazing photography. So,
well, speaking of which, that kind of ties into my last key that I lifted from IMDb. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Jackson formed his own special effects company so that he could do this stuff cheaper and do it in New Zealand. However, George Lucas is a big key to this film for other reasons.
Yep.
Shots that were too visually complex to be conveyed on a storyboard were rendered digitally on a computer in a stage known as pre-visualization. This is the kind of stuff that just blows my mind. Jackson received a lot of pointers from George Lucas and his Star Wars producer, Rick Callum, at Skywalker Ranch. Then he went to New Zealand and created his own company to do this. But he had to figure out how through them.
Interesting. Yeah. I've got a key off a key. So we started this season with Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. Jurassic Park was the first time that they really did full pre-viz with like little miniatures and adding some animated or some stop animation dinosaurs so that Spielberg could pre-visualize these shots. Mm-hmm. And then Lucas took that even further into the pre-viz went back to Jackson. And now that's in Mandalorian where they've created this entire, what do they call it?
It's that room. Summit or whatever. It's like green screen, but it's an digital, entire room. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a digital room.
Yeah.
Floor, ceiling, walls.
It's three dimensional.
And that's how they shoot most of Mandalorian and probably Ahsoka and Andor as well, I would think. They're utilizing that. But I like your comparison too of the auteur side of it. You know, Peter Jackson is another George Lucas with these films. This was his vision, what he wanted. He had to create a special effects company to do it. They each got better. He created a cast of unknowns that people hadn't really heard about. I mean, we knew Ian McKellen, we knew Ian Holm, but not to this extent, sort of thing.
No, I mean, Elijah Wood and Sean Astin were not on everybody's radar. Kate Blanchett really wasn't either at the time.
No. So, yeah, so there's a lot of key influence there with that, the way it works. Yeah, it's. I'm really glad we did it. Is it technically science fiction? No, not even by my definition. Is it technically horror? No, although it does have some scary, gory, gross, yucky pus.
Oh, there's a lot of horror in it with Mordor and those orcs, for sure.
Yeah, the terror, you know, the fighting the Nazgul, you know.
And the Nazguls, they're very scary. Yes, exactly.
And it gets scarier in the next two when you see the rise of the orcs even more.
Well, obviously we're closing because we've been running a little long, but that leads me to what I think should be a proposal, and that is that we should probably follow these up every January and do Two Towers next January and the final one in the following January. It'll be our back from Christmas thing.
Return of the King. Yeah, we could do that. Yeah.
Right.
I think that would be cool, but we'd like, let's ask them and see what they
think. Yeah. Let us know what you guys think. And David and I would like to thank you guys for joining us today in this foray into various Tolkien worlds in the very first Lord of the Rings Fellowship of the Ring movie. If you liked what you heard or watched on YouTube, we'd appreciate a thumbs up, a like, a comment would be great. We've been getting a lot of comments lately. We love hearing from you. We are doing listener request or viewer request episodes this season that people have suggested be one for next year. We would love to hear what you want us to cover in these little deep dives into these films that we do. If you're not getting enough of us because these episodes haven't, it seems like every episode we do now is going 2 hours, which is kind of scary. You can always go over to Patreon where we have some deep dives into some of our favorite nostalgic television shows like Star Trek, The Dilithium Chamber, or X-Files Declassified. And I guess that's everything, David. Until next time.
Johnny Has the Keys, the extended
cut. There you go. The extended version of Johnny Has the Keys. Next week, we are going to be back in science fiction land because we did a brief little excursion into horror over Christmas. And I'm looking forward to it. It's back in the 60s. And I will see you there.
All right. I'll see you then.
All righty. Bye.